without exception, for the cooperation, the good conduct, I see Honorable Maneli today is not, he's with us, he's not taken away from us. Welcome, leader. Having said that, though, let me now address apologies. I have the apology of Honorable Soma, who is out of the country, Honorable Qebekulu, and Honorable Nduli, who is in hospital. That's all I have. There are no other members who have sent apologies. Thank you very much. We are going to receive now a briefing from the Public Service Commission on the financial disclosure framework in the public service. If the Public Service Commission is ready, you can shoot, but not to kill.
Good morning, Honorable Chairperson, Honorable Members, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Mike Seluani. I'm the Commissioner in the Public Service Commission. And in the Commission, I'm the convener responsible for integrity and anti-corruption. Maybe just to start at the beginning. I don't shoot, so I can't kill anyone. You are safe. And like I said, it's better to start at the beginning. The PSC is established in Chapter 10 of the Constitution as one of the institutions to strengthen democracy and strengthen the legislature in its exercise of oversight over the executive. And it is an independent, it is independent and must be impartial and must exercise its powers and perform its functions without fear, favor, or prejudice, of course, in the interest of the maintenance of effective and efficient public administration and a high standard of professional ethics in the public service. So we have been asked to provide a briefing to Parliament on one of the aspects that we do. But this aspect is about financial disclosure framework within the public service. The objectives of the framework. This framework was established or was introduced to manage conflict of interest in the public service. So it is in line with promoting a high standard of professional ethics within the public service. And then the overall goal is to promote ethical conduct, accountability, and transparency in the public service. The FDF, or Financial Disclosure Framework, is contained in Chapter 2 of the Public Service Regulations of 2016 and provides sufficient legal basis for the disclosure of financial interests. It is also incorporated in in Chapter 1, and you find it in basically the Public Service Regulations on how it functions. In March 2017, the Minister for Public Service and Administration issued a determination and directive on the categories of employees to disclose their financial interests. And these categories are as follows, meaning it is other categories, because the ones that we have been dealing with all along, it has been senior management services. So other categories include the OSD levels, who must disclose by the 30th of June, level 12 deputy directors, who must disclose by 30th of June too, and then ethics officers, who must disclose by 30th of June, and then level 11, which includes OSDs, also, or this one must disclose by the 31st of July, and employees below level 11 in supply chain and finance units, which must disclose by the 31st of July. The assumption here is that we all know that with respect to senior management service broadly, they disclose by the 30th of April to the head of departments, and then the HODs, the heads of departments themselves, disclose to the ministers or MECs by the 30th of April too. And then both the MECs, ministers and HOD must then submit the disclosed forms, of course electronically, by the 31st of May, so that the PSC can then scrutinize those forms. In terms of Regulation 18 of the Public Service Regulations, all members are expected to disclose, as I've indicated. And then upon receipt of the disclosures, heads of departments and EAs must submit copies to the PSC for scrutiny. And then any person who assumes duty as an SMS member on or after 1st of April shall make such disclosure within 30 days after assumption of duty in respect of the period 1 April to date. So if a person joins in September, then within 30 days after he or she joins, then can disclose. So the disclosure happens throughout the financial year. And failure to comply with the requirements to disclose financial interest or not making full disclosure of such interest is regarded as misconduct, and disciplinary action must be taken. So it's a serious issue to disclose, so that SMS members, as custodian of the resources of government, should lead by example, and also ensure that they are not involved in any conflict of interest whatsoever. So those are the details of disclosures. So people would disclose shares, equity, loan accounts, trusts, consultancies, movable property like cars, and immovable properties like houses or land, etc. So those are the disclosures that they have to give it, because among those disclosures, that's where conflict of interest may occur. Now, with regard to the submissions over the past 5 years, we can see that in 14-15 financial year, it was about 82% submission. That means 18% of senior management services did not submit. And then throughout there's been a steady improvement, I mean, at 98%, 99%, 95%, and in the last financial year, 97%. So generally, senior management services members are disclosing as requested. It's only a small number which is not, which has not disclosed. And there may be reasons why they have not disclosed. Some of them include that, you know, people were on suspension and did not have access to the system, or others may have been booked off sick and they were unable to disclose. And then throughout the year, the rest are disclosing as and when they come in. Now, once we receive the disclosed forms, we scrutinize them to firstly check if officials have disclosed all the interests, and secondly, to check if there is a potential conflict of interest or a conflict of interest. And potential conflict of interest occur by virtue of an official being involved in a company which is in business, and or official's company registered in the Central Supplier Database of the National Treasury. Now, if a person has a company which is in business, is not involved in any misconduct. However, if that person has that company as in business, there's a risk that the resources of state may be used for that particular company, especially time, so that you find that the time of that official is divided between his or her official duty and the private company that he or she has. So that's where potential conflict of interest occurs. The other occasion is when an official's company is registered on the Central Supplier Database, because every company throughout the country which wants to conduct business with the state has to register on the Central Supplier Database. So now, if you are an official, Senior Management Service, SMS member for that matter, and your company is on the Central Supplier Database, it's a clear indication that you would want to conduct business with the state. And in terms of the directive which was made in 2017 by the minister, that is misconduct for your company to be on that database. So we'll identify such officials once we look at that thing, because we can look at the Central Supplier Database and then check if those companies that are owned by officials are on that database, and then we'll advise the minister or MEC accordingly about that. So that table there indicates number of SMS members 2017-18 up till 2015-16 up till 2017-18. If we look at 2017-18, there were SMS members who were about 10,264. Maybe I should indicate that this excludes members in the state security agency, because they have not been declaring, but we are engaging with the department to look at how that matter is also taken account, even within the state security agency itself. And then the table there indicates head of departments, and head of departments include DGs. So it will be DGs at national level, and then HODs at the provincial level. And then, so that's the number of cases of potential conflict of interest in the 17-18 financial year, 32. And then DDGs, 121. Chief directors, 378. Directors, 1,246. So the total cases of potential conflict of interest, 1,777. So that's really cause for concern that the senior management services members are in a potential conflict of interest, which may translate into actual conflict of interest. Actual conflict of interest involves a direct conflict between a public service official, current duties and responsibilities, and the existing private, actual conflict of interest involve a direct conflict between a public service official's current duties and responsibilities and the existing private interest. It is an impermissible conflict between the relevant public interests that a public official has a duty to protect and their own personal interest. It occurs when a company to which an official is linked is conducting or has conducted business with an organ of state. So we check conflict of interest here when the company has conducted business with the state. So we don't check any other conflict of interest that may happen, but conducting business with the state. Now, with respect to actual conflict of interest, so what we look at is the basic accounting system to check all those companies owned by officials who have been paid by any organ of state, which can go to local government, state-owned enterprises, etc. And then in the 17-18 financial year, only 11 cases were identified of actual conflict of interest. And then 17 in the 16-17, and then zero in the 15-16. So that means in the last two financial years, there are officials who are still continuing with actual conflict of interest. That is misconduct which must be, the official must be called to account in a disciplinary hearing because it's misconduct. So for 17-18 financial year, as I've indicated, it's 11. And then we'd have expected that disciplinary hearings must have taken place. And the relevant MECs and ministers were informed of these cases, and they should have taken disciplinary steps against those officials. Okay, as I've indicated, the executive authorities, ministers and MECs are informed of those actual conflict of interest or potential conflict of interest, or even those officials who have not fully disclosed after checking those things. And we expect within 30 days, according to the regulations, within 30 days after receiving the advice recommendations from the commission, EAs must respond to the commission giving feedback on actions taken regarding non-compliance with the framework, so that the advice that we have given them. Now, key findings and recommendations made over the past 3, 4, 5 years. Mainly, it has been non-compliance with requirements to submit. As I've already indicated, the numbers, the last financial year, it was about 97%. There were members of SMS who failed to submit financial disclosures to their relevant HODs by due date. Some of them, because they expect them to submit by the 30th of April, they submit in May, meaning that this is something that they say that they will be able to do, and then by the time it's 30th April, they realize that they have made a mistake, but they still submit anyway by the in May. So failure to submit by 30th April is misconduct. So the minister or MECs should hold the officials to account. And then there were HODs who failed to submit financial disclosure forms to their relevant EAs by the due date of 30th April. And then there were HODs that failed to submit financial disclosure forms of members of SMS to PSC by 31st May. So you find that SMS members have complied by submitting by the 30th of April, but the HOD, for whatever reason, forgets or not submit to the PSC by the 31st of May. And then only after they are reminded, they come in June, some of them. So already that is misconduct in terms of the regulations. And also there were executive authorities, ministers and MECs that failed to submit financial disclosure forms to the of the HODs to the PSC by the 31st of May. So you find that the HOD has complied to submit by the 30th of April, but the minister or MEC doesn't submit those to the PSC. So all these issues, because we are now dealing with electronic e-disclosure, could be done easily, electronically, so that once they are submitted, automatically they are passed on to the PSC, of course, after they are scrutinized at the departmental level. So legislatures, including Parliament, were advised to hold relevant EAs accountable for failing to submit their financial disclosure forms to the HODs by the 31st of April. And then EAs were advised to hold the relevant HODs accountable for failing to submit to the PSC. With respect to actual conflict of interest, in instances where it was found or where it was identified, it was recommended that the respective EAs or HODs must take disciplinary action against relevant officials and report the conflicted companies to National Treasury for blacklisting in terms of the new procurement regulations, so that that company which is there must be blacklisted so that it doesn't conduct business with the state. So that's tightening the mechanisms up. So if you are an official and you have a company, then you are disadvantaged in that company by conducting business with the state, because it can be reported to National Treasury and then it will be blacklisted. It will never conduct business with the state anymore. Potential conflict of interest, also officials, EAs and HODs are advised to take disciplinary steps against those members who have potential conflict of interest. And then we even go further to say that HODs or EAs must tightly monitor those officials who have companies which is not irregular, but because of that risk that those officials may use the resources of state, such as computers, emails, phones, and even time that is appointed for private interest. So the tight monitoring must happen so that, you know, there is no conflict of interest. So officials who have companies which are in business put a strain on the department in the sense that the department must tightly monitor that official that he or she performs or he or she doesn't use the state resources. And then with respect to gifts and sponsorship, the regulations are saying that all gifts need to be declared. However, gifts of more than 350 rand or more should not be accepted unless permission has been given, which is a very interesting thing in the sense that you don't know that you're going to be given a gift of more than 350, so you can't ask for permission. But once you have received it, you must go and declare it and say, this one is more than 350, and the HOD or the minister must then give an okay. So that means it gives the minister and an HOD a discretion to accept or not accept, unless if we want to tighten it up, that criteria must be established to say which gifts are going to be accepted and which ones are not going to be accepted. And then remunerated work outside employees' work. And I think this one happens mainly in the Department of Health. I'm not saying it doesn't happen in other departments, but there it happens more often. Mainly because there's a shortage of specialists, if you can take that into account. And because doctors want to be involved in private practice, but they are needed in public hospitals. So I think there was some agreement one way or the other that, you know, they will be allowed to conduct that remunerative work outside private practice, sorry, outside public service. Now, the risks are huge there, in the sense that the resources of state can be taken to be used in the private practice too, same as having a company. So medicines may be taken in the hospital to go and be used in a private practice. And then, so that's where the Department of Health or any other department must be careful when they give permission to conduct remunerative work outside employees' work. And of concern to the PSC is that departments do not necessarily have the capacity to manage this disclosure framework. So the 2016 regulations gave the departments the power or the function to manage conflict of interest, meaning that the PSC is no longer doing the management of conflict of interest. So what it means is that between the 30th of April and the time they are reported to the, they are submitted to the PSC in order to include in the register, the departments must scrutinize those disclosures to check if there is conflict of interest, so that when they report to the PSC, when they send them to the PSC to keep in the register, they must also indicate which officials were involved in a conflict of interest. And then there is ethics officers who must be appointed and working with the ethics champions, and departments have not developed fully to that level where they are able to deal with this. So that's an engagement that should happen between ourselves and the DPSA and the departments to ensure that this capacity is strengthened. And I know that the capacity may not necessarily be strengthened unless the resources are put in. And government is experiencing serious challenges when it comes to funding at the moment. But that's the matter, so that must happen. Otherwise, the regulations are not worth the piece of paper written on, in the sense that they will be written on there, but no one implements, and there are no consequences for non-implementation. Or there will be a continuous explanation that we do not have the necessary funds to establish that capacity. Now, with respect to challenges that we've experienced over the years that we've been dealing with the financial disclosure framework, currently the PSC relies on the e-disclosure system and databases of other institutions in accessing the data it needs to conduct an effective scrutiny of the financial disclosure forms. So we rely on CIPC database, the deeds register, e-NAFIS, e-disclosure, and all other systems which are not connected to one another. And with the advent of or the development of ICTs, it would be easier to have a system where you'll be able to read all the databases at the same time and then be able to identify those officials. Such systems already exist. I think SARS has those systems that they can check all the databases. Then even the AG has that system where he can check all the databases easily. But the PSC doesn't have that system yet. We're relying on the e-disclosure to be able to do that work, but still not improved to that level of detail yet. And Parliament is requested to impress upon EAs the significance of the framework and why they should cooperate with the PSC in its endeavor to improve on its monitoring of the implementation of the framework. So that includes addressing challenges of systems, whatever. So the portfolio committee must engage with the DPSC and all other departments to improve and tighten this mechanism. Maybe sometimes it may not be necessary to bring in new money to invest in that system, but to look at the existing systems that can do that and see how they can be shared amongst all departments. So I think CETA and all other National Treasury DPSA should work in a smart way here to see how we can share these resources in order to minimize potential or actual conflict of interest. I think, the above mentioned challenges leave the PSC with the option of designing these systems, but that may not be necessarily a useful venture, but maybe to discuss with all other departments which have the systems and see how we can share these resources. For this to succeed, the PSC needs financial resources, of course, and support from EAs. So support from EAs on how to deal with these issues, or cooperation of executive authorities. And the political buy-in should guarantee, among other things, free access within the confines of the law to relevant data that is stored on the databases of these institutions. If I have to indicate, for example, PSC has to pay some fee to be able to access the deeds register, and that is register of the state. And then in terms of the constitution, the department responsible for the deeds register should provide that information to the PSC so that it can use that. So I think that's where Parliament should intervene to ensure that there is that support from all relevant departments. I thank you.
Thank you very much. We did not introduce the presenter from the Public Service Commission. He is Mr. Michael Silwana. Michael Silwane. So whoever is going to present now must introduce himself or herself. But we will have the DPSA presenting, and let me acknowledge the presence of the Deputy Minister, Honorable Sindisiwe Chikunga. But before the presentation is made, I think I can allow you to give us the preview of what we are going to get in the presentation. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, Honorable Chairperson, Honorable members of the Portfolio Committee, members of the media, DG, of the department, the DGs that are present, PAC. We are again happy to appear before the Portfolio Committee as per the constitutional mandate of Parliament to hold the executive accountable. We are here to present the implementation of the revised determination on other remunerative work to prohibit public servants from doing business with the state. On the matter of the implementation of the revised determination on other remunerative work to prohibit public servants from doing the business with the state, the members are aware that the Public Service Regulation of 2016 provides for a prohibition on public service employees conducting business with an organ of state, and that is Regulation 3C. Just to remind all of us, it states that an employee shall not conduct business with any organ of state or be a director of a public-private company conducting business with an organ of state unless such employee is in an official capacity a director of a company listed in Schedule 2 and 3 of the Public Finance Management Act. In this regard, as the department, we will be here to provide you with the statistics and figures on whether we are making any progress in that area. Safe to mention that we have, in keeping with the amendments in the regulations, we have informed the departments about the application of these regulations to special advisors of ministers and, of course, public administration employees, and that contravention of this prohibition was now made a crime. There are names that have been identified and confirmed that they may actually be doing this, and they have been in handed over to the South African Police Service. And we have, I think the DG will explain that just this year, the department, together with SAPS, including NPA, met to discuss progress on these issues. But the details of that will be covered in the presentation. Let me at this moment hand over to the DG, who's going to present how we have done in this regard and how are the departments complying with the regulations and what is the way forward. Thank you.
Good morning, Honorable Chairperson, Honorable Members, Deputy Minister, colleagues. My name is Richard Levine, and I work at the DPSA. It is indeed an interesting presentation, this. In 2013, I was here with the Public Service Commission. As the DG of the Office of the Public Service Commission, we raised the issue in Parliament of banning or imposing a ban or a prohibition on public servants doing business with the state. And this, in a sense, talks to the journey we've undertaken on implementation of that particular idea through the legislation that we will be discussing here, and our attempts up until the point that the Deputy Minister made to implement consequence management through a partnership with the law enforcement agencies in South Africa. So in this presentation, we'll look at the purpose, we'll look at the background, look at the measures, look at the enabling regulation of the public service regulations of 2016, and look at some concluding remarks and the way forward. So really, we do want to share with the committee progress on the implementation of Regulation 13C of the Public Service Regulations of 2016, which prohibits public service employees from conducting business with an organ of state. we did make a presentation last year in September to the Portfolio Committee and presented a number of statistics. In February 2017, the National Treasury found that 8,495 public service employees were registered on the Central Supplier Database, 5,366 from provinces and 3,129 from national departments. So these were the employees listed, and of those 8,495, 580 employees were actually conducting business with an organ of state. At the end of March 2018, the National Treasury found 15,070 public service employees registered on the Central Supplier Database, 10,315 from provinces and 4,755 from national departments. Of the 15,070 public service employees listed, 679 employees were actually conducting business with an organ of state, 183 from national departments and 496 from provincial departments. The DPSA reported that 20 departments provided progress reports to the DPSA, 10 from provinces and 10 from national. That was by the end of August 2018, and a further two by September 2018. The Portfolio Committee requested the names of identified employees and their departments from the DPSA in order to address their non-compliance, and these details were provided in December of 2018. Now, in terms of the Public Service Regulation 13C, an employee shall not conduct business with any organ of state or be a director of a public or private company conducting business with an organ of state unless such an employee is in an official capacity a director of a company listed in Schedule 2 and 3 of the Public Finance Management Act. Section 8 of the Public Administration and Management Act, PALMA, of 2014 states that an employee may not conduct business with the state or be a director of a public or private company conducting business with the state. A contravention of subsection 2 is an offense, and any person found guilty of the offense is liable to a fine or imprisonment for a period not exceeding 5 years or both a fine and imprisonment, and constitute serious misconduct which may result in the termination of employment by the employer. To assist with implementation of these measures, the Minister for the Public Service and Administration approved two directives. The one was in November 2016, the directive on other remunerative work outside the employee's employment in the relevant department is contemplated in Section 30 of the Public Service Act. And this directive introduced a standard process for public service employees when applying for other remunerative work. The directive on conducting business with an organ of state, this directive of January 2017 outlines what is meant with conducting business and provides a list of 10 activities that are excluded from the definition, such as teaching activities. There are many public servants. Public administration is an interface between practitioners and academics, and hence there were a number of public servants who conduct teaching, lecturing, and tutoring at universities. So after consideration, it gives an example of one of the activities excluded from the definition. To undertake these excluded activities, however, the employee must still apply for other remunerative work to assess for possible conflict of interest. Now, in order to monitor the implementation of this regulation and to provide support, a number of measures were undertaken. From 1st of March 2017, the National Treasury started to monitor all new registration of public service employees on the online central supplier database by matching prospective suppliers against the personnel salary system using an identification number. If a match is obtained, the person is flagged and then required to provide proof that he or she is not a public service employee before registration may continue. And this database contains the names of all individuals and companies wishing to obtain government contracts. The PERSAL system itself was amended to capture the other remunerative work approval process so as to enable the DPSA to monitor applications which may involve conducting business with the state, and comparing it with data contained in the electronic financial disclosure system, the e-disclosure system, and the central supplier database. The DPSA continuously identifies employees possibly conducting business with the state and communicates this with the relevant departments in order for them to take the necessary steps, bearing in mind, of course, that public administration is decentralized, and the functions of discipline are the functions of a head of department. So that's the spirit in which we communicate with departments. In January of 2017, letters were forwarded to executive authorities identifying officials registered on the central supplier database and those conducting business with the state. Heads had to take action against officials in line with transitional measures and create awareness on the regulation. And a circular was communicated in June 2017 to urge action, and a progress report was presented to Cabinet in November of 2017. Again, in 2018 February, further letters were forwarded to executive authorities identifying officials registered on the central supplier database and those conducting business with the state. Heads had to verify the presented information and, where necessary, take action against officials. The Minister requested feedback by the 31st of March 2018, and in September, a progress report was submitted to Cabinet, and by September 2018, 22 departments had reported to the DPSA. In December, the DPSA provided the Portfolio Committee with the names of employees and departments possibly conducting business with the state. In 2019, the DPSA started to verify the individuals on the list by personally contacting departments to assist with verifying if employees are still in service and to confirm the allegation that a particular employee is conducting business with the state. Verification, however, was considerably hampered by the National Treasury's decision to deny the DPSA access to the Central Supplier Database because of Protection of Personal Information Act concerns. This was resolved ultimately, but it did delay the process significantly. As at the end of April 2019, and this includes cumulative statistics from 2017, 17,700 public service employees were registered on the Central Supplier Database. They were not conducting business, but there's obviously a risk that they would do so in the future. In terms of actually conducting business with the state, just over 1,068 were conducting business with the state, 798 from provinces, and 270 from national departments. So this actually shows an increase from 2018, where only 15,070 were registered on the Central Supplier Database, and 679 were conducting business with the state. And the information was matched between the Central Supplier Database and Paracel. So just to run through the status, again, in terms of national and provincial departments. In national departments, 28 possibly have employees conducting business with an organ of state, and 16 have no employees conducting business with an organ of state. In KZN, the figures are 13 possibly conducting business and one not conducting business. In Gauteng province, 7 possibly conducting business with an organ of state, 7 no employees conducting business with an organ of state. Northwest, 5 possibly, 7 not. Eastern Cape, 10 possibly, 2 no employees conducting business with an organ of state. Limpopo, the figures are 9 possibly, and 3 no employees conducting business with an organ of state. In Mpumalanga, 8 possibly have employees conducting business with an organ of state, while 4 have no employees conducting business with an organ of state. Free State, 8 possibly, and 4 not. Northern Cape, 9 possibly, and 3 have no employees conducting business with an organ of state. And Western Cape, 4 possibly, and 9 no employees conducting business with an organ of state. So in conclusion, up until now, only 22 departments have provided feedback to the DPSA. 2 indicated that they were compliant, the Department of Public Enterprises and the Department of Arts and Culture. And 10 more departments indicated they were reviewing the data submitted by the DPSA and undertaking investigations. They listed their DERCO, Environmental Affairs, Water and Sanitation, Department of Justice and Correctionals, including the NPA, the National School of Government, KwaZulu-Natal, Department of Education, Gauteng Human Settlements, Gauteng Social Development, Limpopo Public Works, Roads and Infrastructure, and Limpopo Department for Cooperative Governance, Human Settlements and Traditional Affairs. By the end of March 2018, more correspondence was received, where 8 more departments reported, Department of Telecommunications and Postal Services, GCIS, Tourism, Trade and Industry, Science and Technology, DPSA, Eastern Cape, Safety and Liaison, Department of Human Settlements, with one asking for an extension, the Western Cape Provincial Department, and in July a comprehensive update was provided. Another 2 provided information at the end of September 2018, the Department of Human Settlements, the Western Cape Provincial Department, and the Department of Health in the Western Cape, but very few reported outcomes of investigations that had been undertaken and informed employees registered on this Central Supplier Database to deregister. In terms of the way forward, from May 2019, the DPSA started to verify the identified names with their relevant departments to ensure that they are still employed, correctly flagged, and conducting business with the state. Those confirmed will be handed in batches to the South African Police Service and National Prosecuting Authority for investigation and prosecution. In June, on the 24th, the first 20 public service employees who are conducting business with the state were handed to the South African Police Service and the National Prosecuting Authority for further investigation and prosecution. On the 2nd of September 2019, SAFS and the DPSA convened a meeting to discuss progress on these cases, and it was resolved that the NPA will be included in the next meeting in order to develop strategies for prosecution. The DPSA is also in the process to finalize another 20 names of employees to be handed to the South African Police Service before the end of November 2019. Honorable Chairperson, Honorable Members, Deputy Minister, thank you very much.
Thank you, Prof. Lavin. Honorable Members, both presentations are now open for discussions, deliberations, comment. Honorable Clark.
Thank you, Chairperson. If I just...
How you are going to follow each other? I don't want to move there and come here. So I will conclude you three there and then come over to you. The last will be Honorable Kibi. and yourself after that, yeah. Honorable Clark?
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm just looking at both of these reports. Firstly, when I look at the PSC report and what they are having to grapple with in terms of budget and operational needs in order to do their jobs, once again, I have to highlight this because it seems like in every report that they present to us, these are the problems that they experience. They do all the good work, but there's no results from that because they have budgetary problems, and I think their powers are also not in place in order to make a concerted effort. And I think, you know, that's something going forward in the committee we're really going to have to debate and look at how we're going to fix this. Secondly, you know, if I look at the financial disclosures, the HODs are the biggest problems. I mean, that just shows you that they're not showing great leadership in their teams if they're the ones that are the great offenders. And HODs are supposed to take action against staff that trade business with the state. Now, if they're not supplying their own financial disclosures, you can clearly see from this report that the HODs are also not following through as to what they should be doing in terms of what they discover within their departments. And I think the HODs that are not dealing with this issue, we should summons to this committee and put pressure on them to say, you know, you need to be dealing with these issues and tell us by when you're going to do that. I would also like to see a new report, which is of the status quo of officials dealing with the state and, you know, in terms of business. And also, if the SAPS could come and present that report to us so that we are clear where we are with these issues and if they actually are being dealt with. And then also, Chairperson, you know, I also think that there are in many instances where we should be doing lifestyle audits, which we're not doing. And I can tell you from my own experience when I was in the province of officials that earn a certain amount of money per month and have four or five houses where their bonds exceed their earnings, and an unbelievable high lifestyle. And how do we prevent spouses, getting contracts through the state and the employees of those spouses benefiting in any case? So, I mean, that's an issue as well that we need to start looking at. Thank you.
Honorable Malazu.
Thanks, Chair. I'll be brief because my colleague has covered me mostly. I just want to check on two points. There's a part of the presentation that makes reference to where executive authorities were advised to take action against the highlighted officials. But there is no indication of the percentage or the number of instances where such was done, and tracking it further to establish whether eventually the advice was implemented or not, because the purpose of advice in this instance is not to be heard only, it's for it so that it is considered and executed, particularly given that there is a deviation from the legislation here. And the other part is perhaps something to consider going forward with regards to financial disclosures, if it's not in the current legislative dispensation, as to whether is it useful to have incentives being payable to officials who have not completed the process of financial disclosures. Because for me, that is a key element in terms of compliance with legislation, but also fulfilling the objectives of the job at hand. Because you can't have, I don't think it's useful to encouraging behavior that is ethical, but also making sure that there is just strong compliance with the regulations with regard to the behavior of senior public officials, and in fact all that incentives should be rewarded where there is no compliance with all the requirements, particularly an important task such as financial disclosures, because ultimately the prospect of that is to take out any risk whatsoever of conflicted behavior. I'd like to get the department's views on that. Thanks, Chair.
Honourable Shriver.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Thanks for the presentations. I have a question maybe just for some clarity on the last presentation regarding public servants doing business with the state. So to summarize the recent developments from 2017 till 2019, it appears that there's been an increase in the number of public servants doing business with the state from 798 to 1,068, which is about a 33% increase. And then in terms of the public servants that have been referred for prosecution and investigation, 20 out of the 1,068. I just want to confirm, if those figures are accurate, it seems that the problem is growing. And while I commend the work of the department on those 20 cases, it represents 1.8% of all public servants doing business with the state. So if this is accurate, I just want to confirm for clarity, then I would like to find out, how does one ramp up the ability to prosecute while the problem seems to be growing? So what is the department's intention on getting a grip on this problem, which seems to be getting bigger and bigger over time? And 20 out of 1,000 is not a lot yet, but I'd like to get a bit more information on that. Thank you, Chair.
Nede, I can see Honourable Malatsi want to come back. I don't want to be unfair to those who have indicated that they want to question. Maybe let me conclude the list as I have noted, and then I will come back to you. Honourable Manel.
No, thanks, Chair. Let me also join those who welcome the reports, both from PSC and the department. Maybe just to go back to this question of the increases from the previous year to this year in terms of the number of employees doing business. Mm-hmm. To what extent is that repetitive? Because we also need to check whether indeed there's consequence that goes with this. That it may probably be the same people that were in the previous years, but still appearing on the central database. And this question is linked to the fact that there is already legislation prohibiting this from happening, and that there must be action taken. So that we know whether these are just new employees in the true sense of new, or actually it's a repetition of the same people, and that there's nothing that has been done in this regard. But again, just to check from a point of socialization of employees as they come into the system, has that aspect been looked at? May it be just an issue of them not being aware, or awareness, or it's just lawlessness? So that at least we also understand the nature of the problem that we are dealing with. I'm raising it still again on the basis that reasonable assumption would be that they know that legislatively this is prohibited. So if you can also speak to that. But maybe one other issue to raise really is that we are just from the BRRR process, and there are issues raised by the AG in terms of regular expenditure and all that. It may also be interesting, Chair, to check whether there is no relationship with what we are discussing. Maybe even when we look at the investigations on irregular expenditure or fruitless, wasteful expenditure, to what extent are companies that are involved in the actual delivery of such services also linked to people that may be doing business with the state? I'll submit for now. Thank you.
Honorable Malule.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and also join those who are welcoming the presentation from both the PSC and the department. Chairperson, I'm not sure whether I will be irrelevant or relevant on this one, but I just want to find clarity on this thing. We are saying the FDF, it seeks to prohibit employees who do business with the state of Oregon. Thank you. Because if you check on your slide number 5, it says FDF incorporates part of Chapter 1 of the Public Service Regulation, which deals with the prohibition of, among others, conducting business with any organ of state. But then we come back and say they must disclose. So I'm not sure whether are we not contradicting ourselves there. Because really, I think what is being done by our employees, that is why the AG finds that there are irregular expenditure and these other things. And when you look deep into what is happening, some of the employees are also involved because they conduct business with the state of Oregon. So I just want to find clarity. Why are we saying they must disclose, whereas there's prohibition on them in conducting business with the state of Oregon? And the other one is, you are saying there are 10 activities that are excluded from the definition of remunerative work outside the employment of the employee. And I see we have got doctors, nurses, lecturing, teaching. Can you elaborate others? I just want to find out within that 10, which are those activities? And maybe the last one, it would be, since some of the executive authorities, they don't provide feedback to the PSC on action taken regarding non-compliance with the framework, what is it that you are doing to ensure that the EAs, they really report back to the PSC? Thank you, Chair.
Honorable Mzoipa.
Thank you, Honorable Chair, and I would like to thank the presentation that was presented. I've got only one question that says, and increase of public servants aware of the laws governing ethical conduct of the public servants once appointed in the public service? What can the remedy to empower them of legislative prescribed in their inception, is this doing in their inception or doing awareness campaign during the course of the time? And then for making them, how do you make them aware to conscientize them that what they are doing is wrong? Thank you.
Honorable Kibi.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. In most of my questions have been covered by my colleagues here, but I just want to know, there are officials that are found to be having business with the department. And I want to know whether those officials, when they are identified, are they asked to remove potential conflict of interest? Do they resign from the public service or from business where there is potential conflict of interest, and who follows up whether they have taken either of the two steps when they have been identified. And also my second one is, how is a gratification gift determined, whether it was given in good faith or it was solicited, enable automatic verification and generation of scrutiny reports on financial interest. I just want to know, I'm now out of order. How is a gratification gift determined, whether it was given in good faith or it was solicited to influence some business decisions or preferences? I just want to get clarity on that one. Also on public servants doing business with the state, within the Department of Public Service and Administration, how many employees are conducting business with the state and registered on the Central Supply Database?
Honorable Malas, can make, if there's anyone who wants to make a follow-up, you will indicate, so that I'll allow you to make a follow-up question and then the responses thereafter.
Thanks, Chair. My apologies. Something just came to mind as my colleague was speaking. The point I want to inquire is the extent of measuring conflict of interest that affects spouses of government officials doing business with the state, even though this is about it's about officials doing business with the state. Many a time there's been instances where, while the connection is not direct, because the spouse may not be working for the state, but that conflict of interest is arguably undeniable. So I want to establish from the department, in terms of measures it has in place with dealing with conflict of interest of public servants having a direct benefit from individuals who are doing business with the state. Thanks, Chair.
Honorable Manelli, I can see you.
Thanks, Chair. Just to follow up on that question about the nature of the problem. As these financial interests are registered, has there been any way of looking at the level of indebtedness and how that would relate to those that are doing business with the state and those that are not doing business with the state? Who would you say is heavily indebted in that regard? Just to also understand the behavior in the public service. Thanks, Chair.
Responses? Honorable Deputy Minister?
Thank you very much. I think I will just respond on very few issues raised, if not just two. You know, some of these things that we are discussing here talk to management of departments, pure management. The Honorable Member is asking the question about awareness campaigns, for instance. Under normal circumstances, you would expect that a person who gets employed in a department gets orientated for a week or even more than that. Amongst the things that will be covered in the orientation will be disciplinary processes, grievance procedures, the department itself, how it works, the work that the person will be expected to do. And things such as this will therefore form part of the orientation. So pure management, person is new, gets to know about these things in the department, in the branch. You'd normally expect that during the course of the year, there will be branch meetings, for instance, DDG calling the staff, reminding them about these things, checking whether they are done, and so on and so forth. Are people complying? Is there a person doing that? There's information that has come. We discipline a person, because in this case, you have got two approaches. One, it's a criminal offense, but two, it's a disciplinary case within the department which must be followed. So they talk to those things for me, as far as I'm concerned. If we were to do it effectively, you'd just do it on two people, then the rest will comply, because they will know that I've been disciplined, so-and-so has actually been disciplined. I'm not talking about even going to the court, because of course you can go to SAPS. But if it is done properly, people will therefore comply, because there has been a process followed, disciplinary process followed within the department, within the branch, and therefore people will comply going forward. Then, of course, taking it to police, because it's a criminal offense if it is proven to be happening. So that is the first one for me. Normally you'd expect that everybody in the public service, more so because also after that, then people that get employed in the public service have to undergo orientation with NSG, National School of Government. Such things should also be covered, because what else do you want them to know if they don't know such important basic things that actually can let them into jail? So that will be that. So for me, doing business with the state is both a disciplinary matter, but also a criminal matter. And two processes, therefore, have to be followed within and outside. And if it doesn't happen, it actually might be saying, are we managing these things effectively as departments, as branches, as supervisors, and so on and so forth, before they get out of hand. We do acknowledge, ma'am, that you raising the issues regarding the budget, particularly of the PSC. Indeed, it is a problem. But I understand that as from next year, they are going to get their vote now. So it's no longer going to be, and it is DG. It's no longer going to be via the Department of Public Service and Administration. It's going to be their vote. So that will actually strengthen their independence even more. I think that will be that. The rest will be responded to by the DG and the head of PSC. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Look, obviously the challenges of resources are challenges to the PSC, but they're also challenges to the DPSA in terms of the resources that we can muster for the various things that we need to do in terms of our mandate. But clearly, the questions are observing the trends, and the trends are worrisome. The Honourable Member Clark has also raised the issue of unexplained wealth. So the draft regulations, which we have formulated and we will be gazetting for public comment shortly, for a number of matters, including what we'll be talking about in the next presentation as well. There is a specific regulation which deals with unexplained wealth, which will then be the trigger for the lifestyle audit. Because obviously, in all these matters, we have to deal with the Protection of Personal Information Act, and we need to deal with the provisions in the Constitution, which do actually provide for all South Africans to engage in trade, and that's where the challenges come with the questions around the extension to spouses, which is in the legislation in terms of declaration. But there's a lot of constitutional challenges, I believe, that will arise through the implementation of that. Nevertheless, the department will go ahead and formulate regulations and extend the declaration of interest to spouses and other family members where relevant. But it will be a fraught process because of the Bill of Rights. And that raises the other element of the questions that have been raised, and that is because ethical questions are not exclusive to this country or a particular province, as we see. Ethical questions are questions that globally all countries are grappling with. And we know that if you look at the work of the OECD, for example, the work it undertakes on governance globally, the biggest challenge with governments today is public trust. So those contexts are real, and a number of interventions are conducted on an ongoing basis around education, awareness raising. Every public servant that comes into the system must go through an induction program. And in that induction program, ethical issues are raised as well as awareness in the SMS induction more than others around the need to disclose and why. A lot of work on promoting integrity has been done in the department. We have with us Dr. Solomon Hochenrath. He could maybe even elaborate on some of the programs. But last year in September, Cabinet also took a decision to make an online ethics course compulsory for all public servants. That online course was developed in partnership with the DPSA and the National School of Government. So the observation is correct that the problem is growing on the face of it, although the problem to determine exactly how much the problem is growing is also a function of understanding the extent to which detection is improving, the ability to detect, as well as the extent to which the various frameworks and awareness programs are gaining traction within the public service. But obviously with all these things, the role of leadership is fundamental, and I think the Deputy Minister has referred to that leadership example or leading by example is really, really critical when it comes to winning this particular battle that we are fighting. The financial disclosures have been in place for many, many years. There was an anti-corruption conference right at the end of the first administration, post-1994, during Mandela's period, and that's when the PSC began to become active in the space to develop a financial disclosure system, which ultimately became an online system managed by the DPSA. So over the years, there have been a lot of steps that have been taken. The problem has deepened. But I think the measures that we have put in place now are much stronger and more robust, and hopefully through the current process with the police and the prosecuting authorities, we will be able to begin to turn the tide. I would like to repeat that in order to understand how to deal with compliance issues, we do need to always consider the decentralized nature of public administration. If one reads the Public Service Act, yes, there are overarching powers of the Minister for the Public Service and Administration, but on a unit-per-unit basis, it is the Minister and the MEC who hold the original powers of administration, which are then delegated to an HOD and in turn from an HOD down to other senior managers. So I think in terms of the feedback from EAs, yes, that is a challenge. Obviously from these two presentations, it's a challenge to the work done specifically around financial disclosures for the Public Service Commission as much as it is a challenge for the Department of Public Service and Administration in order to try and enforce these new frameworks. And we are increasingly saying that with the establishment of the Public Administration Ethics, Integrity and Disciplinary Technical Assistance Unit, the DPSA will have to move into the area of enforcement in as much as with the Office of Standards and Compliance as well, the DPSA will need to move into the area of enforcement. And that will constitute a shift in the way in which the department has been functioning going forward. I think I would like Dr. Hochenrath to talk about some of the preventive measures, the guideline on gifts, because there was a specific question around that, how we get public servants to distinguish between a gift which is given in good faith or a gift which ultimately constitutes a bribe. And he can also elaborate on the various activities which have been excluded over and above those mentioned already. I think the question on level of indebtedness, I think one can conduct analysis around the extent to which this is a contributing factor. We have done studies on levels of indebtedness, and these are important studies which show that public servants, like many, many other South Africans, are highly indebted, so they are then susceptible to taking bribes. I think that is something that needs to be taken into account. One can conduct a broader analysis of possible causes of corruption as well, which relate to the larger political economy and the extent to which the society has been transformed, the extent to which the private sector has been transformed, and the extent to which these are contributing factors to the kind of contract practices that we've witnessed over the last decade or so. Those are certainly factors to take into account when one is trying to deal with these immense problems of professional ethics and corruption. But I think Dr. Hoekenraad could possibly just assist with those two areas. Thank you. Through you, Chair.
Take the floor. Thank you, Chairperson. Maybe to just address another issue as well, there was a question if there's anyone in the DPSA doing business with the state and if that person is registered. And as at April 2019, there was no person in the DPSA either on the CSD or conducting business with the state. So if I can then address the issue of preventative measures and then the activities excluded. Because it's such a serious issue after April 2019 when it became a criminal offence, there was a number of preventative measures put in place before then to guide public servants so that they would understand if they remain on the CSD it will become problematic. We had a number of circulars that was issued. There was a lot of correspondence addressed to the heads of departments. But besides that, we also worked through the National Ethics Officer Forums, of which we had five now already. It takes place once a year, so it's an annual forum, where we then addressed the issue of gifts, other remunerative work, financial disclosures, all the conflicts of interest, taking the ethics officers through that process to make them understand that they should go back to the departments and explain to officials the gravity of being on registered on a central supplier database. We also drafted numerous toolkits, Q&As on other remunerative work and doing business with the state, and we have the two directives that we also published to guide people, where we also do monitoring on the implementation of the guides and then published yearly monitor reports to see whether there was improvement or not. And also published guides on gifts and other remunerative work, and we're currently also busy with one on conducting business with the state, with numerous one-on-ones as well. The most effective tool that we saw was the online code of conduct, which Professor Levine referred to, that was in 2017 launched, and up to date, 10,000 public servants voluntarily enrolled and finalized the course, where we deal in depth with the issues of what is a gift, what is other remunerative work, what's the relationship between other remunerative work and conducting business with the state, why you cannot conduct business with the state, and so on. So there was a number of preventative measures, but as the minister indicated, it's not enough. After April, this is now a criminal offense, so we need to make examples of those people
that we need to go through. Although there's 1,068 people identified, not all of them are doing business with the state. We need to go through one by one to see if there's not a false flagging or they were appointed in official capacity. And we found now, even the 20 names that we've submitted to the police, there's almost 30 that we found on the list that's not really conducting business with the state. So it's a tedious process to go through and see which of those. We've already handed another 20 names this month to the SAPS and prosecution authority to look at how to come up with a prosecution strategy for this. Then if we look at the 10 activities excluded, I cannot remember all 10 of them, but the idea behind this was to cover the issue of organ of state versus the state, which is under the PAM, we call it the state. Under the regulations, it's about the organs of state. And it had an unintentional consequence where you say you cannot conduct business with the state, where there was officials that was marking exam papers for UNISA, or they contributed to knowledge building, and they were then suddenly found to be conducting business with the state, and that was not the intention. So those ones, we excluded them to say we will not take that as doing business with the state. I can remember the reservists, the police reservists, the military reservists, those were also excluded so that we don't sit with the unintended consequences of people that is doing after-hour services to the country and then they were found doing found to be conducting business with the organ of state. One of the others was health officials that have specific skills to look at issuing certificates for disabilities. If you would stop that immediately, it would have a serious impact on service delivery for SASSA. And then also activities around professional development, veterinary students that must go to Onder Support and do work there, then that would be deemed as conducting business with the state. What we've done to mitigate that it cannot be abused is to say if you want to do those functions in any case, you need to apply for other remunerative work so that it can be screened to see if you are a lecturer at NSG and you are developing curriculum for UNISA. That obviously is wrong. It can't be accepted. So then the ethics officer will see that it's a conflict of interest and will not approve that specific one. So if you're on the list, it doesn't mean that you exclude it. You can go continue with it. It just means it's excluded as to be considered as an organ of state so that you can still apply, but it doesn't guarantee that you will get that. If there's a conflict of interest, then you will not be allowed to do so. Thank you, Chairperson.
Public Service Commission?
Thanks, Chairperson. I think most of the questions were addressed, but it's important to show the sequence of events here. The financial disclosure framework existed long before the PEM Act, which was signed into law in April. Then initially, non-disclosure or conducting business with the state, whatever, they were only misconduct. And then the Public Service Commission, in managing the financial disclosure framework, always made recommendations, and I think it's important to note that Professor Levine has, you know, the organizational memory because he was in the Public Service Commission, went into DPSA, came back into the Public Service Commission, and is now also in the DPSA. So all these recommendations which were made, I think he's aware of that. One of the recommendations was that conducting business with the state must be prohibited, and then it was captured into Public Administration Management Act, PEM Act, which only became into force this year in April. So that's one of the issues. So most of the issues are now going to be discouraged because they are now criminal offenses to conduct business with the state, unlike in the past where it was only misconduct and people could explain themselves out of it. Now they have to explain themselves into a court of law. So that's why there will be that discouragement. And the work that we do between ourselves and the TPSA, it's almost like the same job, but it should be looked at differently in the sense that maybe TPSA is internal within government to advise departments, to empower departments to be able to deal with these issues. And then PSC will give an opinion on how these matters are dealt with into the legislation. So it's similar to the AG and National Treasury. National Treasury deals with the external issues in terms of financial management, and AG comes up with an opinion to Parliament about how whether the finances are being used. So there is that symbiotic relationship between the TPSA and Treasury. And as I was doing the presentation, I was joined by Tshepo Matlhare, who's the official responsible for financial disclosure framework. And there are questions which have been raised about information on the departments which are which have been advised and which have not taken those advice into consideration. I'd like him to talk more about that issue about the statistics of those EAs, even though he may not go into detail about which officials, but how are we capturing this issue.
Thank you. Can take the floor.
Thank you, Chairperson. Honourable members, on an annual basis, the Public Service Commission develops a report, we call it an overview report on the implementation of the financial disclosure framework. So part of that report will indicate the extent to which EAs have complied with the requirement to provide feedback to the Public Service Commission. And the recent stats that we have is that in national departments, the PSC had expected 34 EAs to provide feedback. Only 6 did comply, that is at national level. And these details can be provided because this is just an overview report. We don't have the details here now, but it can still be provided. In provinces, the provincial total was 111. Feedback was only provided by 64, that was in 2016-17, but the latest one, only 53 EAs did provide feedback to the PSC. And also again, like the Western Cape, we had expected 12 EAs to provide feedback, only 10 did provide. In Northwest, out of 11, only 2 did provide feedback. In the Northern Cape, we expected 11 EAs to provide feedback and only 1 did so. In Mpumalanga, at least all EAs did provide feedback. Limpopo, we only received feedback from 1 EA out of the expected 11. And Gauteng, all EAs did provide the feedback. Free State, 6 EAs provided feedback and we had expected 11. In the Eastern Cape, we did receive only 1 out of 12 EAs who were requested to provide feedback. That is, the feedback that was expected was based on the findings that the PSC had made on potential conflicts of interest and, in certain instances, actual conflicts of interest. I would say we'll give, findings about specific officials in those departments. Say so-and-so is involved in a potential conflict of interest. EA, please consult with the official to check the extent of the involvement of the official in a company. What is it that they are doing, and whether that potential conflict of interest may end up becoming an actual conflict of interest, and how is it managed? And the recommendation that we make is that, especially when there's also actual conflict of interest, the discussion must be around how that conflict will be removed. If it's actual and if it's potential, how will it be managed or it does not become actual conflict of interest. So yes, removing conflict of interest means the person must either resign from the company that causes that actual conflict of interest. Most probably it would be that company is conducting business with the state and this person has an involvement with that company somehow. Yes, and so we need to get feedback as to whether any action has been taken, and if any action has been taken, what is that action that has been taken, and if there's no action that was taken, what were the reasons? Because maybe during the discussions or the investigation, the department might find that actually there's no conflict of interest. But then we still need that feedback to see if the recommendations have been considered and somehow implemented. Thank you.
I see Honorable Manelli and...
Yes.
Honorable Manelli, first.
No, thanks. I just wanted to get back to this point because there's a technicality raised about actually doing business and not doing business. If the principle is prohibition, it means once you register on the central supply database, you are making your intention clear that you want to do business with government or the state and its state organs. So as to whether at that point you actually have a contract that's running or not is another issue. Because if the point is to prohibit from doing business, so immediately you get to that space, you are making your intention clear that you want to do business. So I'm just raising this thing because I think even on the audit side, there's always this problem that irregular expenditure does not mean necessarily that something wrong would have happened. There may have been value received from the services that would have happened. And you leave it at that point, then it gets to the worst side of things. Whereas you could have prevented it from that point, that's not the area to go, and there should be some sanction on why are you engaged in irregular expenditure when you know that there are certain things that need to be done accordingly. So I'm just saying that I think the same treatment here, that the overall is to prohibit. And once you get to the database, you are making your intentions clear that you want to get involved in that regard. So I just thought it's important for us to live with that understanding. Yes, the technicalities may be there that no, you do not necessarily have it now, but the fact that you are there says you have the intention. I just thought, Chair, that was not answered accordingly in the way I asked the question. Thank you.
Maluleg?
No, thank you very much. I think Honorable Manele also covered me on that one, because really, if you are saying you are prohibiting a person, but also you allow that person to do something else, then there's this contradiction. But I just want to get clarity on this one. You said some AEs submitted, instead of 11, only one submitted the feedback. Then my question is, what are you doing? Or what do you put in place to ensure that they report, they give you that feedback report? Thank you, Chair.
That picture is not good throughout. I've seen, I don't have a question, but the interest of the committee, I think, is that we must not have that picture. The picture is not good, but I allow you to respond where you can.
Let me sit up first. The issue of potential versus actual. In PEMB Act, actual is now a criminal offense. And we with respect to potential, there's a directive that has been issued by the minister to close that gap, which was in 2017, that all the officials who are having companies which are on the central supplier database must resign from those companies. So it is closed. So no official can now continue to be on the central supplier database. So the directive closed that gap. So there is no way now of conducting business with the state, whether potential or actual. And I think with the rest of the issues, my colleague here will.
Thank you, Chair. Maybe it's good that question is raised because it's quite problematic for the Public Service Commission. We do write to the EAs, first of all, to submit the report of the individual departmental report. And then also, you know, at the levels of officials, liaise with the ethics officers, you know, to follow up and also to encourage them to, you know, make sure that their EAs act on those reports and they provide the feedback. And there will also be follow-ups made. The commissioners of the Public Service Commission do meet with the EAs every now and then, and these issues of feedback is also, you know, discussed. Yeah, but still we find that it is quite a challenge, you know, for the Public Service Commission to receive feedback. It is not forthcoming. If it does, it would come way late when we've even already published the overview report.
Honorable Shreva and Malazi wants to have a follow-up question. Okay. After Honorable Shreva, it's you, Honorable Malazi.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Just for, on the first point about the potential, the gap being closed. So there's 17,700 public servants currently registered on the CSD. That was then despite the directive that was sent out. I just want to see whether that is the correct understanding, because then in theory it does close the gap, but in practice we still have the 17,700 names there. And then on the second point, Chair, I think, you know, it's becoming a real pattern here with our meetings, with interactions with the PSC, that I think it simply means that executive authorities do not respect the PSC because they don't have the teeth and the powers to really take action against them when, you know, they are just being ignored. In our the previous meeting that we had, the one before the last one, we also, I remember, we requested the PSC to send us a list of departments who failed to even respond to questionnaires that were being sent out. So it's really just to note again the pattern that we're seeing every time, and it seems to be an unavoidable conclusion to me that it's a legislative problem because there's not enough power. I have no doubt that if the PSC had the powers, they would have they would act against people who continuously ignore them, because I do have a lot of respect for the PSC and the work that they do, but I think we are holding them back legislatively if we keep hearing this over and over again. So just for noting that again, Chair. Thank you.
Malazi.
Thanks, Chair. I think what is clear for me, just based on the responses here, is the level of frustration that the PSC has regarding what its engagements with the EAs ultimately contribute to. Because if there is a requirement for submissions of, you know, information, particularly for tasks such as these, there has to be an outcome. Because what it does is it also affects the accuracy of these reports that the PSC has to submit at the end of the year and the completion of that. Because if there is missing information, while it shows us trends, it doesn't show us the entirety of the picture, which then gives us a clear understanding of what the true events are across government and departments. And I think while the process of initiating any legislative amendments will be the ideal goal, that will take a long time. But I think there is scope to start elevating the game in being decisive in dealing with such EAs, whether through the publication of those departments and EAs that are not meeting their requirements in terms of the submissions of documents, so that that is publicly available for the public or even for us without having to request that info. Because ultimately, in the absence of a carrot, we must use the stick approach here, so that we can start to change behavior so that we can have accurate information. Because our interest in here is compliance with legislation and regulations that are put in place. And there is clear that, it is very clear that there are EAs that are going to dilly-dally until you have to meet your deadline and to submit the report, and that exempts them from compliance. And we have to deal with accurate information at any given stage. So I would encourage that it's perhaps the time to elevate the game, start publishing and naming and shaming those departments that are not meeting their deadlines that you have set in terms of the compilation of that information, because the credibility of the information is important for any intervention measures that you want to put in place to improve governance across the three spheres of government. Thanks, Chair.
Any comment, Pierce, to the comments made thus?
Just the comments made. PSC has already started on quarterly basis. We have what is called the quarterly bulletin. If I can give an example, there's the issue of 30-day payment, which has been agreed by government in cabinet, which is the Treasury Regulation and Public Finance Management Act, that all service providers must be paid within 30 days. So we've been monitoring this for the past 1.5 years, but not much movement has been happening. And in the last quarter, we provided the departments which are complying and the ones which are not complying. And then as a result, I think there is movement in that regard. So this is an issue that we can consider as the PSC to publish the report, because some of the statistics we have, which departments are, which EAs are complying and which ones are not complying, we may consider to put that information into that quarterly bulletin. But naming or shaming does not necessarily resolve the problem. I think the problem must actually be where Parliament calls those EAs to account, because by ignoring PSC inadvertently, they are ignoring Parliament. And we can even go further. Ignoring Parliament, that means ignoring the people who have elected Parliament. So I think it's when EAs are called to Parliament to account, that may also assist in ensuring that there is compliance. So we will indicate in our reports which officials, which EAs have complied and which ones have not complied. So when we come with the overview report, maybe that's the information to include. So the overview report will be published for 18-19 before the end of the financial year.
Let me thank the public service and also thank the members of the portfolio committee.
The issue of the number of officials, I think that one is for DPSA to look at, because we haven't looked at the 17,000 officials who are on the central supplier database. But okay, so that means we'll have to check all those SMS and ensure that appropriate action takes place to those about those officials.
Thank you very much, Public Service Commission. You can stay on if you wish. You can leave also if you feel like leaving. Thank you very much. Now we are going to receive a progress report regarding the establishment of the Office of Standards and Compliance in the Public Service. That will be done by the Department of Public Service and Administration, but I would give the Honorable Deputy Minister just to give us a preview of that. Thank you. Over to you, Honorable Deputy Minister.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson and Honorable Members of the Portfolio Committee, DG and Senior Managers from the Department of Public Service and Administration. Ladies and gentlemen, we have been requested to report on the progress made thus far regarding the establishment of the Office of Standards and Compliance in the Public Service. Maybe to remind ourselves that originally this office was named as the Office of Standards in the Public Service, which was later legally renamed as the Office of Standards and Compliance as per the PAMA. And maybe also to mention that the rationale for the creation of the then OSC concept primarily revolved around the findings of non-compliance by the Auditor General and the Public Service Commission, that there was an inability of by government to successfully implement these programs across the three spheres of government due to the lack of common norms and standards and the application thereof. In fulfilling the statutory mandate for the establishment of the OSC, the branch in the Department of Public Service and Administration Research and Policy Analysis has undertaken the key projects between December 2014 and November 2019 to ensure the establishment of the OSC, and the projects will be outlined in the presentation by the Director General. It is important, Chairperson and members of the Portfolio Committee, to note that the OSC currently is incubated in the branch research and policy analysis within DPSA, but we are finalizing a new structure for the department, which actually might put it elsewhere than in that branch. On the matter, I think, Chairperson, we will therefore now allow the DG to take us through the presentation that will give us the details about the work of the OSC. Thank you.
DG, Professor Lavin.
Thank you, Honorable Chair, Honorable Members, Deputy Minister. As the Deputy Minister has indicated, I will be looking at the establishment of the Office of Standards and Compliance. The Minister also requested I make reference to the Public Administration Ethics, Integrity and Disciplinary Technical Assistance Unit, because obviously it also has importance in terms of the earlier presentation, both of the DPSA as well as the Public Service Commission. Okay, no problem.
Continue.
Okay, it's not changing here. I don't have a problem with my eyesight. It's changing on the screen, but not here. Okay, so I should just take that. Okay. Okay. as the Deputy Minister indicated in her preamble to the presentation, the Office of Standards and Compliance, as well as the Technical Assistance Unit on Ethics, Integrity and Disciplinary Support, are mandated through the Public Administration and Management Act of 2014, PAMA. And then, as also she indicated, with effect from the 1st of April this year, a proclamation issued by the President operationalized these units. And as the Minister has reported in this committee previously, he is finalizing the structure for the Department of Public Service Administration. He has, in fact, given me the structure, which I will be sharing with the members of the Executive Committee of Managers tomorrow. Okay, the legislative frameworks that we need to understand in order to understand how these institutions, in particular the Office of Standards and Compliance, are being implemented are the Public Service Act, Section 3(1) of 1994, where the Minister is responsible for establishing specific norms and standards relating to 9 functional areas, which would include the functions of the public service, organizational structures and establishment, conditions of service, labor relations, health and wellness of employees, information management in the public service, electronic government, integrity, ethics, conduct and anti-corruption, as well as transformation, reform, innovation, and other matters that can improve the effectiveness and efficiency of the public service. The Municipal Systems Act is also relevant, and there are issues in Chapter 12 as well as in Section 120 on regulations and guidelines. And this is because the Public Administration Management Act and its regulations have application at the local sphere of government. So there's a number of matters which include community participation, integrated development planning, performance management, local public administration and human resources, and so on and so forth, which will be impacted on by PAMA and its regulations. And then Section 16 of the Public Administration Management Act talks about the minimum norms and standards in 8 functional areas, including the promotion of the values and principles referred to in Section 195(1) of the Constitution, capacity development and training, information and communication technologies in public administration, integrity, ethics and discipline, the disclosure of financial interests and measures to improve the effectiveness and efficiency of institutions, disclosure of information relating to pending disciplinary action, and the conclusion of disciplinary proceedings and any other matters. So, again, the Public Service Act obviously refers to the particular norms and standards. This came through the amendment in 2007 to the Act. And then it also has reference in the Public Administration Management Act, as I've indicated on the slide up on the screen there. And sorry, there's a problem here. Technology. Yeah, it's not changing the slides up there.
If the technology is letting you down, I think members do have the copies of this presentation. You can present from the copy.
Okay.
Yeah. Because technology is like that at times.
Okay. Well, my apologies for that, honorable members. If we could maybe go to slide 7. Okay, slide 7 is basically showing how the Office of Standards and Compliance aligns with the priority areas for the 6th administration, which are 7 in number, economic transformation, education, skills and health, consolidating the social wage through reliable and quality basic services, spatial integration, human settlements and local government, social cohesion and safe communities, a capable ethical and developmental state. And this is the area where PAMA becomes most relevant, both in terms of the Office of Standards and Compliance, as well as the Technical Assistance Unit. So basically, in the State of the Nation address, the President stated that there is a wider process of arresting the decline in state capacity and restructuring our model of service delivery to best serve our citizens, and that we will begin, we will build on the work we have already begun to address problems of poor governance, inefficiency, and financial sustainability, and the commitment to building an ethical state in which there's no place for corruption, patronage, rent-seeking, and plundering of public money, where we want a core of skilled and professional public servants of the highest moral standards, who are dedicated to the public good. Now, in the budget vote speech of this year, the honourable members will remember that the minister identified 5 key priority areas: the full implementation of Batu Pili, the full implementation of PAMA, achieving higher levels of stability in the public service, fighting corruption, and policy implementation. And the implementation of the units in terms of the proclamations issued by the President are in fact part of the process of implementing PAMA. So if we look at chapter 8, section 17 of PAMA, it outlines the objectives and functions of the Office of Standards: to evaluate the appropriateness of norms and standards and their basis of measurement as determined by institutions in relation to public administration and management, to promote and monitor compliance with minimum norms and standards determined by the Minister in relation to public administration management, to advise the Minister on the execution of his or her duties regarding the determination of minimum norms and standards, and enforcing compliance with the minimum norms and standards. And that's the point I made earlier, that with these new units now, the DPSA does acquire a mandate of enforcement in a number of areas related to norms and standards, as well as to the implementation of other provisions that we've been speaking of earlier, which will be under the Technical Assistance Unit dealing with ethics and integrity, but also to conduct capacity and functionality audits of skills, systems, and processes, and advise on capacity building initiatives, and to develop and implement an early warning system to detect public administration non-compliance. In terms of the reporting requirements, the Office of Standards and Compliance is required to submit reports to the Minister and the relevant head of institutions, directing in that report, if necessary, steps to be taken by the head of institution to comply with the applicable minimum norms and standards and assist the institution in taking those steps. The Office of Standards and Compliance is also required to report to the Minister at least once a year, or at the request of the Minister, on the performance of the Office's functions, the effectiveness of the minimum norms and standards, or any other matter related to the Office's functions which may be requested by the Minister. There are similar provisions relating to the Public Administration Ethics, Integrity, and Disciplinary Technical Assistance Unit, which includes providing technical assistance and support to institutions in all spheres of government regarding the management of ethics, integrity, and disciplinary matters, to develop norms and standards on integrity, ethics, conduct, and discipline in the public administration, to build capacity within institutions to initiate and institute disciplinary proceedings into misconduct, to strengthen government oversight of ethics, integrity, and discipline, and to intervene, again, the enforcement mandate where systemic weaknesses are identified, and to promote and enhance good ethics and integrity within the public administration, and to cooperate with other institutions and organs of state to fulfill its functions under this particular section. The TAO unit may perform its functions in respect of a national department or national government component, an office of the Premier, provincial department or provincial government component, with the concurrence of a Premier or upon the request of a relevant Premier, and a municipality with the concurrence of the Municipal Council or upon request of the relevant Municipal Council. And then in the cases of both the OSC and the TAO, there are reports which need to be submitted to Parliament twice a year on the activities of these units. Now, the implementation of the current DPSA structure takes place in the context of the middle of a financial year. And it's important to recognize that budgets have already been allocated. The elections, as we know, were in May. The appointment of the executive was at the end of May. And any changes to the structure of budgets and programs has to be finalized for submission to the National Treasury by June in every budgetary cycle. So additional funding which will be needed to really make these institutions as effective as possible will have to be requested from the National Treasury during the 2020 budget cycle. But in the interim, the department will prioritize key posts that can be created and filled using the available compensation budgets, and operational budgets will be sourced from reprioritization of existing allocated goods and services budgets of programs and branches. Now, if we look at the Office of Standards and Compliance, since April of if we want to really go back, we will see that over the last period of years, a lot of important work has been done in the development of the work of the Office of Standards and Compliance. So basically, a number of frameworks have been built and developed, and these will include an annual performance report. This will be very, very important, because if we look at the work that the office has done, for example, in productivity measurement and management, which we will speak to some extent, this will allow us to see much better how efficiency and effectiveness can be implemented, that constitutional principle. And obviously the indicators that have been developed over a number of years and tested with various departments and implemented through various case studies will be extremely important in ensuring that the Office of Standards and Compliance is successful in its work. So in terms of the prescribed powers of the Office of Standards and Compliance on the promotion of standards and effectiveness and their appropriateness, systematic reviews on functionality and capacity assessments to measure organizational performance, as well as monitoring of compliance with standards through records, data governance, and an early warning system for preventing actions, and then the enforcement of standards by instruments which direct remedial steps, which is talking about the developmental and corrective consequence management which needs to take place. So then going back just to elaborate on the work that has been done since 2015, following the promulgation of the legislation to prepare the technical instruments of what needs to be done, there is a process which has been going on since the legislation was assented to by the President, of drafting regulations, which, as I've indicated, will be gazetted for public comment shortly. There's a draft strategic framework for the Office of Standards and Compliance. There's been research on standards bodies, and various tools have been developed on the basis of those learnings, both domestically and globally. The issue of setting up national standing set of structures and the piloting of the measurement tools. So these are the processes which have been ongoing to prepare the way for phase one of implementation, which will be a focus on public service institutions. Now, in terms of the regulations, the purpose of the draft regulations, they define the members of the OSC and the process of appointment of such members. They stipulate the duties, powers, and functions of the Chief Standards and Compliance Officer, in other words, the head of the Office of Standards and Compliance. They define the monitoring and auditing powers of the OSC and its members, and it determines the reporting processes, enforcement, response plans, and processes related to the issues of compliance and orders by the Office of Standards and Compliance. Now, it's important to understand that in order for the frameworks which are being developed to be robust and effective, there's going to have to be a big focus on capability and capacity. The capability refers to the human beings and their capabilities. The capacity refers to the fact that there need to be people, there need to be institutions, there need to be systems and processes and laws and enabling for all of this to happen. Monitoring and evaluation will become critical for the effectiveness of PALMA implementation in both the Office of Standards and Compliance as well as in the case of the Technical Assistance Unit on Ethics, Integrity, and Disciplinary Management Support. And monitoring and evaluation is critical for accountability, where departments will have to respond to the monitoring tools that are under development. And then also, obviously, based on the responses and the performance and achievement in relation to the indicators, then departments and institutions across the public administration will learn what has worked, what has not worked, what are the reasons for success and failure, and will also therefore lead to the strengthening of the organization in terms of building its knowledge around the organization and the processes which require compliance with. A big part of the work of the Office of Standards and Compliance will be the establishment of an organizational functionality assessment tool with a specific index, which will be based on institutional functionality from an external assessment perspective, as well as organizational functionality from an internal self-diagnostic micro-environment perspective. And there will be analysis at the level of the portfolio, the program, as well as the policy, as well as analysis of around planning, processes and practices, as well as projects and product. And really, this will give us a better picture of the importance of governance oversight, the role of leadership and stewardship, management of strategy, ethics and integrity, as well as administration oversight, which is a functional analysis and the decomposition, the translation of mandates and service typologies, the structures of operation, the performance management identification, and budgetary and fiscal management. Regulatory performance as well in terms of the ability to translate policy, to deploy it, to improve performance and adherence to relevant norms and standards, and then specific planning tools which exist within the Public Service Act environment relating to the strategic plan, the annual performance plan, the human resource plan, the skills plan, the employment equity plan, the service delivery improvement plan, and so on and so forth. In terms of process management, the DPSA does have capabilities within its service delivery improvement environment for operations management, and it has the DPSA has human resource capacity and development management, organizational development in terms of supporting departments to set up organizational structures which are compliant with norms and standards prescribed by the DPSA, employee relations management, organizational culture, performance management, etc. And then also in order to understand output and impact management, which is capacity and process performance, service sustainability, reliability and relevance, and utilitarian value management for citizens. So this just gives you a sense of the kind of organizational functional assessment scorecard that the department will be developing in terms of the issues I've run through on the portfolio analysis, the program analysis, the policy analysis, the planning analysis, etc., where departments will be given a total score, and there will also be a capability and systems readiness levels in terms of the scores that will be attained, which are illustrated on the right-hand side of the slide. Public service productivity is a major part of what the focus of the Office of Standards and Compliance will be. At the center, obviously, is the citizen expectations and citizen satisfaction, leadership performance in ensuring service quantity and service quality are able to meet the expectation and needs of citizens, as well as ensuring that employee competence and capability are managed, the working places that the working place environment is managed, as well as being underpinned by operation management systems and processes. In other words, how to actually deliver services and the various processes required in order to optimize both in terms of quantity and quality the delivery of those services. So the ability to manage productivity, both in terms of effectiveness and efficiency, will be a huge gain which the Office of Standards and Compliance will bring to the public administration environment. So there's a number of steps and processes which have been worked on under the leadership of DDG Colette Clark, who is with us and who obviously will participate in the engagement session that will follow. There's been a lot of engagement with departments in across the public service about the kind of tools, minimum norms and standards which are being contemplated, the framework of the public administration norms and standard has been engaged with across the public service and will need to now be popularized or build greater awareness around it. The implementation of an early warning system, making sure that we develop the necessary capacity and capabilities for data management. Also, obviously, the performance management and development system going forward would have to be linked to productivity measures. And in order to assist all of this, we do need to have digital government or an acceleration of digital government so that these systems will be managed electronically. A functionality index will be developed. There will be an assessment of data quality, as well as a governance framework for the Office of Standards and Compliance. The actions and interventions which will follow now will be more especially once the regulations are promulgated, having gone through a public comment process, is the actual setting of the public administration minimum norms and standards, the application of those norms and standards, and then building the monitoring evaluation capability in order to measure efficiency and effectiveness and ultimately to enforce compliance. Thank you very much, Honorable Chair, Honorable Members, Deputy Minister.
Thank you, Members. The presentation is now before the Committee for Deliberation. Honorable Kibi.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. I want to welcome the presentation by the Office of Standards and Compliance. Honorable Chair, my first question is, when cost and time to deliver a service has been determined in terms of norms and standards, will the Office of Standards and Compliance certify that such service has delivered on time within budget? And will this evaluation be commuted to the annual report of a department being evaluated? And my second one is, will the office go on site for inspection, or it will rely on desktop information and reports from the departments and municipalities that must comply with standards? If so, will capacity be enough to carry out this function in the entire public service? Those are my two questions, Honorable Chair.
Questions. One being that because there's an element of monitoring and evaluation, and we've also received a report from the PSC that also look at some of those aspects. And therefore the question would be, what will be the difference in terms of what this office does? As it relates to that aspect of monitoring and evaluation, what is the difference between what this office would do? I'm saying on the part of the slide you talked about monitoring and evaluation, as well as what the PSC does, because there's also that element in the work that they do. How will that be managed in a way that this is not seen as duplication, if you get what I'm saying? I think the other issue is that when you referred to the legislative framework, you also mentioned that local government level, you'll have the Municipal Systems Act, which from a point of office, it would be more of your quota. Minister, as you refer to minister in that regard. Now, looking at ensuring that these norms and standards are also at the municipal level, how are you going to manage this part of the reporting in particular? Because if this office reports to the Minister of Public Service, I'm saying at a political level, and at a local government level, the reporting is more to the Minister of COGTA, how is that going to be looked at? But maybe just to check the issues that relates to authority. At what level would be the head of this office be? And probably the skills or educational requisites that are needed to get to that position. Thank you.
Honorable Clark.
Thank you, Chairperson. This is a very interesting question that I'd like to ask, and I'd like to know what is the difference between this office and the DPME, as well as, you know, the PSC. What are the different functions, and how do they then find synergy together in order to do evaluations?
Can the department respond?
Together with Ms. Clark, the DDG, who has been very much behind the preparatory work for the Office of Standards and Compliance. I mean, I think ultimately the office will have the capacity to look at particular services. It will build that ability over time. So it would be able to act as an early warning system for service delivery breakdowns in certain areas. It will use on-site as well as desktop research or analytical methodologies. But ultimately, its ability to go on-site or to have something which may approximate towards an inspectorate will be determined by availability of funds. And that, you know, will obviously talk to the final part of the question around the capacity for covering the entire public service. certainly, the Office of Standards and Compliance will make recommendations in its various reports. It will undertake reports which will obviously take shape over time. There's been a lot of thinking of the type of reports, which I'm sure Ms. Clark will share with the committee. And it will include annual reports, which will give a global position on certain aspects, which are comparable across departments and sectors, as well as specific aspects which deal with service delivery improvement initiatives in specific sectors. the issue of the duplication, which has been asked by two of the honourable members. The DPME increasingly is looking at monitoring and evaluating the implementation of the NDP. So the medium-term strategic framework, which is being finalised by Cabinet at the moment, is very much focusing on NDP implementation. The work that was doing through the MPAT is going to be transferred to the DPSA to carry on this kind of work, but within a different framework through the Office of Standards and Compliance. Yes, it's true that PAMA brings into effect norms and standards for the entire public administration, which in the initial phases will be for national, provincial, and local government. But many of the things we talk about, if we talk about the earlier discussion on lifestyle audits is not only for public service, local government. Ultimately, it will be for all organs of state. It will ultimately be for all branches of state, if one can put it that way, because one has to have integrity assured across all the branches of the state. The issue of the authority of the head of the office, that will be finalized in the implementation of the new structure where job evaluation will need to be applied to this post, as well as the post which will lead the technical assistance unit on ethics, integrity, and disciplinary management support. So also, I think with the PSC, there would need to be discussions going forward in terms of making sure that there is no duplication. Of course, the PSC, as we have referred to in several occasions today, is an independent constitutional body. which means it would take its decisions independently in terms of exactly the kind of work it will do, its work plans and so on and so forth. But I think in the practical reality, it would be desirable if there could be a better understanding to minimize duplication between the Office of Standards and Compliance on the one hand and the PSC on the other. But I'd like to give Ms. Clark an opportunity to also engage with the committee around some of the questions that have been posed. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Good morning to you, honorable members. Just to indicate and develop further in terms of the responses provided by the DG, the instruments that we've designed are from the existing legal frameworks and also the authority that has been conferred on particular constitutional bodies like the PSC. Just to use the analogy, Treasury, in terms of the Constitution, it's very clear in terms of the norms and standards Treasury has to set for the general acceptable accounting practices. Within Treasury's own realm, they have the Office of the Accountant General, which is separate from the Auditor General. But the relationship between the Office of the Accountant General and Treasury is very, very clearly defined in relation to the accountant, the Office of the AG. Now, whether you've got the PFMA and the MFMA, MFMA in the realm of local government, PFMA in the realm of other government institutions, you would find that the role of the Accountant General is dealing with the applicability of the norms and standards both in municipalities as well as in government institutions. This is extremely similar in terms of arrangement in that if we go back to the Constitution in terms of Chapter 10, public administration, the principles of public administration are applicable to all administrations in all three spheres of government, as well as it indicates organs of state, and it also indicates public enterprises in Chapter 195. Now, why is that important? It's important in the sense that what Palmer did was then limit the minimum norms and standards in Palmer for which the Office of Standards has to check the appropriateness of the norms and standards that are set are only focusing on administrative norms and standards which are applicable to public administration in the areas that are included that the DG has already presented on. That is extremely important. What it also says is the following. In evaluating the appropriateness of the norms and standards, if the Office of Health Standards has already set up an office, this office actually checks the appropriateness for the aspect of the administrative ones, not the technical health ones. The technical health ones will be then still dealt with by health in terms of the authority that has been conferred on the Minister of Health. Similarly for education in terms of NEDU, that deals with the norms and standards from NEPA in terms of education. Now what is extremely important, which we've clarified quite nicely with DPME, is if you've got the stratification of who's supposed to do what. DPSA is responsible for the black box and the operation of the black box, meaning what is happening inside the department in terms of the operations of the department. And those are the technical standards, but linked to the administrative functions. You find that the input, the black box, and the output, we must ensure that what comes out of the black box in every department is meeting a particular standard according to the norm that had been determined. For the purposes of Treasury is dealing with the allocative efficiency-related standards, insofar as they are in the PFMA. DPME outwardly, as the DG rightfully said, is dealing with how the cascading of the NDP to the various programs in line departments have got specific critical success factors in that they're going to be responding to the NDP. So they're dealing with the program effectiveness. And the program effectiveness, if it's a governance arrangement, it's dealing with the aspect of social accountability to citizens and the measure of the efficacy of the policies that have been chosen by the governing party of the day in terms of how those have to be delivered, which are then in the MTSF. And that becomes extremely important. So you'll find that the instrument that we've designed in terms of the organizational functionality index, it's got two levels. The one level is for the external control reporting points, reporting to Parliament, reporting to Cabinet, reporting to the Accountant General, reporting to the Presidency that is responsible for governance, and any institution that is supporting the Presidency as a centre of government for the purposes of governance oversight. But if you look at the lower level, which is the micro level is the public management part. Now, there's been a problem since 1994. There's been an overemphasis on public management and an underemphasis on public governance. So you're finding that there has been a problem. So what the instrument is doing is making sure that there's accountability for all the things that are from a public governance perspective and those that have to be measured inside in terms of the public management perspectives. But what is very clear is the instruments that we've designed for the Office of Standards that lead up to aspects of inspection. Efficiency is measuring, by and large, the quantitative aspects of the cost and the time and the tangible stuff, which can give you ratios. The effectiveness is measuring the qualitative aspect in terms of whether we're getting the desired impact that we're supposed to be getting. But just responding to the aspects of the inspection in the draft regulations, we have included that particular power and authority to deal with inspections. So the important thing is that what we're starting to see internationally in terms of trends, if you've got 100% of organizations, usually 20% of them are performing way above what you're expecting them to perform at, 60% are meeting the compliance, and 20% are usually not meeting the compliance. Meaning that if we are fitting in with international standards, by and large, the inspection should be in those 20% of departments and institutions that may not be meeting the compliance level against efficiencies as well as against against effectiveness. But this becomes extremely important because the inspections will only come after you have issued a compliance order, and that is in the draft regulations, meaning that you were given a development plan, you were given a response plan to respond to not having met the requirements. And therefore, if you haven't, then there has to be an inspection. Now, the early warning sign would be the decision to go and intervene in a department, in a municipality, will be based on a scientific methodology to determine that you have to intervene. Just to deal with the issue of the municipalities, in the same way that Treasury deals directly with COFSA for the purposes of assisting them in reporting back against the implementation of the MFMA, against the norms and standards that are set, and that still gets to the accountant office of the Accountant General's office, it will be in exactly the same way that DPSA, Minister for Public Service and Administration, would be reliant on the Minister for Cooperative Governance to provide exactly the same data for municipalities insofar as whether they have met the requirements against the minimum norms and standards. Because the way that they have to domesticate the measurement instruments to get a functionality index will be contextual to what is the mandate of the municipalities, which is slightly different to what is the mandate then of government departments for the aspect of general administrative norms and standards, the way we're going to measure it. So the tools are quite clear in terms of what is the construct we're measuring, what are the dimensions, what are the domains, what are the factors. Those are all the same, but the descriptors will be different. So the descriptors in health, in education, in a municipality would be different, but at the end of the day, you're measuring exactly the same factors, the same domains, the same dimensions, and the same construct, which is functionality. And the importance about the monitoring evaluation, there's two things why you monitor and evaluate. The one is to ensure that you've got to prove that you did something, which means that there is a legal obligation to report, and you also have to improve, meaning that it's for developmental purposes. So we need to balance in terms of what the findings are. And the training then and the capacity would come on the side of the development requirements that may be unpacked in terms of just one example on capacity and capability. If you had a 200-bed hospital and the Department of Health said that you must have six clinicians, and they do have six clinicians, But the Department of Health said, according to the standard, four of those have to be particular specialisms and not just general practitioners. But the hospital goes and appoints six general practitioners. They're going to have a problem with capability. They don't have a problem with capacity, but they're going to have a problem with capability. And they cannot carry out what they're supposed to carry out because the skills are not what the requirements specified. And hence, those would be evaluating the appropriateness of the norms and standards set by that particular sector. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Let me thank the Public Service Commission, thank the Department of Public Service and Administration. Thank you, Honorable Deputy Minister, very much. You are free to leave if you wish. If you wish to stay on, fine.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. We would definitely wish to leave.
Okay, you are...
And thank you very much at this stage.
Thank you very much. You are all released with pleasure. Honorable members, we will now tackle item 6 on the agenda. I nearly made a mistake here. Yeah? Let's deal with the minutes of the subcommittee first before we go to this subcommittee meeting of the 19th of November. I think all members have that. Anything on page 1 on that report? Page 2? Page 3? That we can the committee approve this? Can I see indication of the approval, Honorable Malule?
Thank you, Chairperson. I move that we adopt the minutes of the 19th of November.
Honorable Malule, Honorable Gibi.
Second the proposal, Honorable Chair.
Let's go to the report there of the 20th November. We'll go page by page on the report. Page 1. page 2. Page 3. Page 4. Page 5. Page 6. Honorable Shaiba.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Let me just speed read here to make sure that I express myself accurately. 5.3 flows over the two pages. So, 5.3, yes. Chairperson, I think 5.3, the final sentence, so that's on page 6, I think a more accurate wording would be the final sentence, with the exception of the Democratic Alliance, based on paragraph 5.2 above, there was consensus on the way forward. That would be my first bit of input. And then flowing from that, so I don't know if that, was that noted, Mr. Sibeko? Did you get that?
Yeah.
You got that, okay. Sure. And then the conclusion, I think, as well, I would like to...
Sorry, Honorable Chair, but I'm hearing that the other guys, they say they want you to repeat what you said.
Yes, okay, let me just repeat that.
Yeah.
So, point 5.3 on page 6, I'm just suggesting that the final sentence there, which currently reads, however, based on paragraph 5.2 above, there was consensus on the way forward. I would like to request that we adjust that to say, with the exception of the Democratic Alliance, comma, based on paragraph 5.2 above, there was consensus on the way forward. I think it's an accurate reflection of what took place. And then flowing from that, in the conclusion, I would also request that the point currently reached, 6.1, the Portfolio Committee is therefore confident that the above recommended candidate for the appointment has a clear understanding of the mandate of a Commissioner of the Public Service Commission. I think again here it should be noted, just start the sentence with the exception of the Democratic Alliance, comma, and then the rest of the statement as it currently stands. And then let me just, if I may, speak here with my colleague. Okay. Chairperson, those are the two suggestions I would like to make. I think it's a fair reflection of the meeting we had yesterday. Thank you.
What the members are saying to that? Honorable Gibby?
Thanks, Honorable Chair. I don't think there is a problem with that one. It can be on the report. Thank you, Honorable Chair.
All members are seconding the proposed endorsement. Can I, everything now must be on record. The mover and the seconder of this, Honorable Kibi.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. I move for the acceptance of this report, Honorable Chair.
Any seconder to that? Seconder.
Yes, I'm seconding the report with the amendment made.
Oh, with the amendment made. Okay, no, that we hear that. Thank you very much. Yeah. Let's now do the minutes. We have a big day today. And bear with the office of the secretary, honorable members. We've been, that's why I'm saying we must bear with you, because the problem was with us. We were deferring minutes. We were not adopting them in the meeting. Now they became this badge, so that we must not put blame to the secretariat. I will therefore begin with the minutes of a set of the 18th September. Let's go page by page on that. For the same date. Honorable members, for ease of reference, these minutes, it's a badge that starts with the meeting of the 18th. Are you with me on that one? Then, before we deal with them, let me make sure that every member has the correct set of minutes. That's the 18th September, 8th October, 9th October, 15th October, 16th October, 6th November, 13th November, 23rd October. It's a loose one. It's not part of the batch. Okay. Let's start with the 18th September. We will go page by page and then adopt immediately, so that we don't go back and forth. I'm on page one on the set of the 18. Page two. Page three. Page four. Page five. Honorable Saber.
Sorry, Chair, can I just request a little bit slow? I don't know how quickly other members read, just a little bit.
Okay, let me go back to page four. Page four. Page 5, I think I was slow enough. Yeah. Page 5. Page we present that set for adoption. Any mover for adoption for that set? Honorable Kibi?
Honorable Chair, I move for the adoption of the first set of minutes of the 18th of September for adoption.
Honorable Kibi? Honorable Malati, be on record.
I second.
October 18th. October 8th. Sorry for that. We'll go page by page as well. I'll be slower once more. We are now on page one of that set. Honorable Maluleka.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think my apology was not registered here. On that day, I was attending another portfolio committee meeting.
I remember that the Honorable Swama did table it. Yeah. Then I'm on page two. Yes, two. Page three. Page four. Are presenting that set as well for adoption. Any mover for adoption? Honorable Kibi?
Honorable Chair, I move for the adoption of the set of minutes of the 8th of October.
Any seconder to Honorable Kibi? Honorable Clark?
Thank you, Chairperson. I'll second the minutes.
Minutes adopted. Let's go now to the meeting of the 9th of October. Page 1. Page 2. Page 3. I will take a bit of a time for members to read that page 3, which flows over to page 4. Can I get a mover for the adoption of that set? Honorable Kibi?
Honorable Chair, I move for the adoption of the minutes of the 9th of October.
Can I get a seconder to that? Honorable... Let's move now to the meeting of Honorable Maneli.
May I just check the chair? just for purposes of record, that in the way the minutes are, yes, they are summarized. But for somebody who was not in the meeting, maybe like there was no interrogation of the reports that were presented. I'm just saying that even if it was a one-liner, that indicates that the observations and recommendations of the committee would reflect in the actual BRRR report that would be presented, so that it's aligned to the adoption of the report that follows after that.
I will allow our officials to respond to that, but normally that's how we do them, but I'm not closing them out in terms of responding to what you are raising. Any?
Thanks, sir. Afternoon, honorable members. Through our unit in committee section, we have been advised that whenever we do BRRR or annual reports, we do not have intensive minutes, but rather all the deliberations and engagements are then tabled in the report. So you might not see any information that is tangible on the minutes, but the report has got every detail of what transpired on the day. That is how we've been advised to process the pitchable processes and the annual reports. Thanks, sir.
Honorable Malazi.
Thanks, Chair. I just want to establish if am I correct in presuming that with the BRRR reports and the annual report, they would have reflected the committee's resolutions if there were any relating to the presentation, or whether it just follows that format, because with ordinary committee meetings where there's been specific resolutions that were adopted by the committee in response to whatever content was presented, such resolutions would have been noted.
My fear is that we've been adopting minutes in this way, but if this is a new recommendation by the committee that as to how they should be, I think it must not. Okay. Honorable Clark and Honorable Maneli and Mr. Mwepe.
Thank you, Chairperson. The request was that if we make any recommendations at the meeting, that we get a document with those recommendations served to the committee so that we can see whether the recommendations we are making are being followed up or finalized, and so that we can then also, as a committee, monitor all those recommendations.
Honourable Manes.
Now, Chair, I didn't ask that we get the detail of what was recommended.
Yes.
All I was saying was that in the reflection of the minutes, because minutes will also become public information.
Yes.
In the reflection of minutes, it shouldn't be like there was never a discussion. That's the point I was trying to make. It's just a reference point that says observations and recommendations are captured in the actual report. That's not the detail, but it does direct you there, so that we then handle the part that Honorable Clark raises of following up on the actual recommendations later on in the report itself. So it was not to change the format of the minute. But of course, for all other minutes, we've been able to capture the sense of the discussion. That was all, Chair. But again, if in terms of the standard said it's not permissible, I will understand. I was just indicating that it shouldn't be like it was just a meeting presentation, conclusion, the Chair adjourned the meeting. Thanks.
Is there any addition on Mr. Mwepe?
Yeah, no, I think, Chair, through you, we got what the members, because these minutes are for the committee. Therefore, if they feel that we have to include things like resolutions per, let's say, meeting, then we can highlight that, and the tracking tool as well, for to track our decision, so that we we check as to how far are we in terms of implementation of the decision that the committee makes. So those things are the things that we can sort of come the first quarter of next year, then we can factor them in the new set of minutes. But for now, we'll allow the members to, we'll request the members to look at the minutes, and if then they can adopt it. But the next step then will change the way they want the minutes to reflect.
I think that's a fair comment, honourable members. Let's agree with that. Yeah. Okay. Let's go now to the meeting of the 15th October. Page one of that set. Honourable.
Sorry, Honourable Chair, on the issue raised here about the minutes, can it be captured on the minutes that we just adopted now to say this is what the committee would want to see in the following minutes? Or am I out for that?
They will, you see, today the Secretariat is also taking minutes. So all what is being raised must be captured in the minutes of today. Yes. Thank you. Let's page one of meeting of the 15th of October. Page two. Page two flows to page three. Get a move for adoption of this set. Honourable Gibby.
Honourable Chairman, I move for the adoption of this minutes. Unfortunately, it's only me.
I see members are getting tired of moving. And okay, there. Any second to Honourable Gibby. Honourable Malasi.
Chair, I second.
Thank you. The minutes are adopted. Let's now move to the set of the 16th October. We'll go page by page on that one as well. Page one. Page two. Page two. Can I get a mover of this set? Honorable Kibi.
Honorable Chair, I move for the adoption of the minutes of the 13th of October. Thank you, Chair.
Second to Honorable Kibi.
Chair, there's nothing controversial there, I second.
Of 6th November. Page 1 on that set. Page 2. Then I'll move to page 3 and the and be a bit slower there? Page 4. Page 5. Can I get a mover for adoption of that, Honorable Clerk?
Thank you, Chairperson. I would like us to insert in these minutes how extremely worried this committee is about the functionality of these two song centres. Because it doesn't reflect that in the minutes, and I think each one of us sitting here raised that concern, that these two song centres are actually, many of them are not functioning at all, and that we would take oversight and go and see how these centres are functioning so that we can ensure that the investments we've made in these centres are actually utilised by the community out there.
Yeah, I think that will be put in because it was raised. Yeah. Then let's move to page 5. Can I get a mover for the adoption of this set, Honorable Maluleke?
Chairperson, I move that we adopt the minutes of the 6th November 2019 with the amendments made.
Honorable Clerk?
I second that. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Members. Let's move now to the set of the 13th November. Okay. Oh, yes, 13th November, page 1. If we've forgotten the 13th, it was last week. Page 2. Then I will take some time on page 3. I'm on page 3 now. Page 4. Page 5. Can I present this set for adoption? Any mover for adoption of this set? Honorable Kibi.
Honorable Chair, I move for the adoption of the minutes of the 13th of November.
Any seconder to Honorable Kibi? Honorable.
I second the
minutes. 23rd. October is the loose set, 23 October. Page 1. on that? Page 2. Page 3. Honorable Manet.
Yes, sir, I was present. Just at the end there of the sentence, it's mines instead of miners. And on 2.6, just right at the end, the district delivery model. Yes, I'm saying the collapse of the interministerial has been replaced by the district delivery model approach. So I'm saying right at the end there, it's not just the department, but it was stated as through the district delivery model. Yeah.
Yeah, and also on the issue of Northern Cape, where they did not give any response, they said that they will go and investigate and come back. But
yeah.
It was not
there. Yes, so yes, you are right. Yeah. Mm. It will be included there. Otherwise, any mover for the adoption of this set? Honorable Manel.
I move with the corrections made, Chair, for Minister Bertrand. Thanks.
To Honorable Manel. Honorable Malule.
Thank you, Chair. I second the minutes.
The minutes are now adopted. Honorable members, let me take this opportunity now to thank you for the cooperation we have displayed throughout our meetings. Yes, we have differed here and there, but we have done that with dignity and respect. I have honored that very much, because there was no instance throughout where our meeting had to collapse because there were some disagreements. We were able to manage disagreements and then move forward with a consensus view of the committee. Thank you once again for that. I have heard, I'm not going to mention other, I've heard that it was not the case in other meetings. Thank you, let's keep like that, honorable members. Remember, all of us here in this committee, we are representing our people. In the work of the committee, we are representing people. Thank you very much. This is the last meeting for the term. And I wish every one of you a happy rest when the house has adjourned for the festive season. You must come back in the new year very much invigorized. If we are not going to meet again, you must have a safe journey back home until we meet again in the new year. Thank you very much, honorable members. The meeting is now adjourned.